Welcome to Physics 142.
Either that's the class you were looking for, or I'm in the wrong room. Okay, so, alright, I must have made it to the right place. Actually, it was visiting with my daughter who was in Buffalo Sunday, and I was sitting there, and one of her friends came in and remarked that my classes were starting Tuesday at the bar. I was like, what? I thought it was Thursday. So, happily for all of us, her friend made that odd comment. Otherwise, this might have been a very, very short class. At any rate, so yesterday I worked on the syllabus, and I want to tell you a bit about how this will work. I should remark, if you didn't get email yesterday, it probably means you're not officially somehow registered in the class because you're not connected with the Blackboard email and thing. You need to let me know. I can add you in manually, but you also want to fix that because sometimes people who are not officially registered get randomly deleted or something, and you want to make sure you're getting emails from me. At any rate, so the nature of the class, just to make sure we're all on the same page, it is a class where we will cover introductory electricity and magnetism. This class is designed for physics majors. It's maybe one of my very favorite classes to teach for many reasons. The subject matter is absolutely spectacularly beautiful. We are going to have some really wonderful moments together. It's great stuff, and I think you'll actually agree with me by the time we're done. The other thing I like about this class is because it's sort of for physics majors, I would say people are sort of more or less interested in it and work hard, so the culture is usually pretty good. What this really means in this class is that part of what I want to do is to teach you a lot of tricks of the trade, things that will be useful in the upper level classes. So not only will we be doing electricity and magnetism, but sometimes I'll be giving you very particular types of problems and going through why we're analyzing it certain ways. And one of the things I love about this class is I feel like I have license to tell you how to do all these things and give you practice in it, but not basically throw you in a pond and say, sink or swim. The next class or so, they'll expect you to be able to do a lot of that stuff. But I think it's sort of, I get to sort of help you through it. So I think that that's a lot of fun. On the other hand, I will help you, and then I will expect you to do it and be able to do it. So one of the things that's going to set this class apart, say, from maybe a Physics 122 probably, but in 114, for example, it's also a calculus-based class, but I wouldn't expect them to be very comfortable in using it in setting up problems. That's like the very high end of what I would expect them to do. We do a little bit of it in that class, but not much. Here, you're going to eat, sleep, and breathe it. You're going to get good at doing integrating over charge distributions in, you know, all the reasonable shapes to do. And I will try very hard not to give you impossible ones, particularly on exams. I think I've done that once. It wasn't pretty. But I'll try not to do that very, very hard. You know, when you make up a problem, you think it's a cool problem, and then you do a solution, but you make a mistake when you're doing the solution, so you think it's a doable problem. And then in the middle of the exam, somebody comes up and asks you a question, and realize, oh, crap, I got that wrong. And then you sort of, oh, that's not going to work out well. That's not a good teaching moment, actually. Okay, so what does this really mean? I want you to have had some calculus. I want you to have seen integrals. I mean, I'll introduce some stuff. But you may not, I don't know how to say this nicely. What I find is in calculus, what most of us pick up is sort of how to mechanically do some stuff, but we actually don't know why or how to use it. And here I hope to teach you the why and the how to use, but I'm not expecting you to come in automatically knowing that. So So that is going to be one of the big things we're going to pick up here. Okay. Occasionally I have people who try to slip into this class who haven't had mechanics yet. If that's true, you probably don't want to be in this class. It's not designed for that. I'll be assuming you know mechanics. It's part of what makes this a great class is because we can sort of build on that. It may be electromagnetism, but we'll still have mechanical problems that involve electromagnetic forces. I'm Steve Manley, by the way. I am your professor. That is my email address. This is my office phone number, and that is my office number. You're welcome to call, and you're welcome to leave messages. And back in the old days, I used to actually pay attention to that, but almost nobody calls me now. When they do, it's a wrong number for the medical center. So I've sort of fallen to not even checking my messages. But if you do, you know, if I'm there, I will pick up the phone. And I'll be totally surprised if it's you and not somebody looking for the medical center. My advice is just email me or stop by the office. The office is easy to find. You just come in off the quad onto the quad level of Bausch & Lomb and just turn right and walk, and it's the last door on your right. I sent out a syllabus update because I realized it had the wrong office hours on it. So just pay some attention to that. So let's see, about office hours. Well, actually, let me stop for just a second. Does anybody have any... I'm going to tell you about how the class is going to work and everything, but does anybody have any actual questions about what the class is supposed to be about? All right. So what you'll find if you look at the syllabus, which I'm not really going to just flash up on the board because you've all got copies and I just really wanted to talk about it more. You'll find that I have listed one measly office hour, Tuesday 2 to 3. And I will make an attempt to be in my office then and happy to talk to you. But the reason that I do that is I have to travel a lot, and I know you guys are busy, so it doesn't actually matter what hours I pick. Many of you won't be able to make it. So what I really mean for you to do is when you need to chat about something, you email me and we'll find a time that it works. So I don't mean to make it look so minimal when I just put that 1 hour. I put the 1 hour because I have known students who just absolutely couldn't get their head around that they should email me and find a time. They wouldn't actually ever come talk to me if I didn't have an office hour listed. So I've listed an office hour, and I will try to be around them. I'll usually let you know when I'm out of town. I'm a particle physicist, and I'm doing one experiment at Fermi Lab and one in just north of Tokyo. So sometimes I... just out of the spirit. As far as I know, I have 2 trips scheduled right now. One in a couple of weeks, and then one at the start of October. So generally what I'll do when I travel is either make you take an exam while I'm gone, so it doesn't waste your time, or I will do sort of careful slides, annotated, and then give an MP3 lecture with it, and then post it online, and you're welcome to listen to it whenever you get a chance. Although, when I get back, I will have assumed that you've listened to it, so you want to do that. Do you have a question?
I'm not there.
Sorry, I told you to wait a second, and then I forgot to. So, didn't mean to. I sent out a link to the class website. I know some of you may get annoyed by the fact that I'm going to use both Blackboard and the physics server with my own basic website. There's a reason for that. It turns out that if I form a Blackboard website, it disappears after a few months because somebody thinks this disk space is expensive or something. So if I do my own website, it stays there, and I have it for archival purposes. And I actually do find often I like to go back, and because I remember, oh, yeah, I did that, you know, at some weird class years ago, and I'm going to go back and look at what I did and
pull out the files. And so I find that's very useful for me. At any rate, so what that means is on Blackboard, I will primarily be posting, I mean, maybe we'll do some readings and things. Anything that's copyrighted, I'll post in Blackboard because it's basically inaccessible to anyone outside. I'll post your grades on Blackboard. But other than that, things like homework assignments, solution sets, exam solutions, things like that will all be posted on the web link that I gave you, which is the physics server. Okay? I'll also post lectures, and when I can remember to actually bring my recorder and record them, I will put up an audio as well. Okay? I will post probably later today, possibly tomorrow morning, the first problem set, and you want to, it's due on September 11th. The problem sets in general they're not online. They are you and a piece of paper and a pencil, which is a powerful way to learn, actually. I don't mind if you work with others. I strongly suggest that you do that a little cautiously. I want you to spend a lot of effort working on the problems before you start talking to anybody else about how they're approaching them. Yes?
Just out of curiosity, September 11th is a Thursday, correct?
Yes.
Did you say
right.
that on the syllabus? I thought it said that it was due Friday at 7 a.m.
Yeah. There's a reason for that.
Okay.
I was sort of thinking it's due right after class on Thursday.
Okay.
And then I thought, but I don't actually care, and what I can do is just delay picking it up until Friday morning. Okay. So I will probably tell you it's due Thursday. What it means, what I'm saying in the syllabus, we won't pick it up till 7 a.m. that Friday morning for you. We may not pick it up till 10 or 11, but I only guarantee not till, you know, 7-ish in the morning. Okay. So it is really critical that you spend a lot of time on the problem sets. No pain, no gain in this class. And it is you have to spend time playing with some of these mathematical tricks for it to begin to stick and for you to really understand it. Every one of you can sit there and I can do a problem and I can tell you a pretty story about how it works, and you'll sit there and go, yeah. And some of you can probably then pull that out of thin air for some problem on an exam or later on, but most of you probably won't. And the way for it to stick, unfortunately, is where you sort of take wrong turns and then finally figure it out for yourself. And this class has a lot of those things, and so we really need to spend time on the problem sets. And in general, there'll be a mix. Some of the problems certainly won't be all that hard, and then I'll try to be putting in a few more challenging ones as we go. That said, part of the process after you're going through it, I don't really expect you to sit there and stare at it all day. So I don't mind if you talk to friends and get some limited help or brainstorm how you think things should be done. I will also post or have in the library, I think, the solution sets from the textbook, which will cover most of the problems, not all the problems. Some of them I'll make up. You know, my guess is if you work very hard, you can find solutions from the last time I taught the class, which happens to be the same textbook, and most of the problems will probably be the same. So I don't care if you use that, but you need to use that after you've beaten yourself up for a while about the problem. Otherwise, it does you just no good at all. But often, if you've really come to your wit's end on some problem and you really aren't sure what in the world to do, it's a really good way to learn to then go and see what somebody has done that makes it work and deconstruct it, work backwards and figure out how to get there. So I don't mind if you do that at all. We are taking up the problem sets, and we will grade a problem or
multiple problems. But we'll start out by looking at one problem just to make sure you're putting in effort. If we begin to see this just a solution set solution, then you're not going to get credit for it. But I just want, for this class, there's really not a whole lot of need for me to do that. But generally speaking, I think it's important to have the deadline because it just basically gets people to hand things in and keeps you from falling behind. Once I, for a while, to me, the whole homework thing is very much of an internal thing that you need to be driving yourself to do. So some physics classes, they like to take them up and grade them very carefully and get them back to you with feedback. And I don't really do that because at least the way I learned, it's more of an internal thing. So I've even run classes where I didn't bother taking it up at all. Just, you've got to get it, you're responsible to get it, you're responsible to figure it out when you do the solution test. And what I found there was actually worked for a lot of the students, but some students would then fall behind because their calculus professor would have a deadline, and they wouldn't mean to fall behind, but they would sort of put off the physics because I didn't have a deadline. So I have a deadline, and we're going to track it, and it is part of your grade, but all I'm really looking for is not necessarily, I don't necessarily want your focus on, I want to get the answer that's in the back of the book or something. I want you to spend time playing with that problem, and I don't mind if the work shows some false tracks, right? That's part of doing it. Yes?
We're still going to get a clear response whether we got it right or wrong, though, right?
You will not get a clear response or feedback about whether it is right or wrong. I'll try to make sure that you get clear feedback as to whether you got credit for it or not, which means if you just write down the answer, you're not going to get credit for this, right? Because I want to see the actual effort. And I don't actually care if you get the right answer or not. I want to know that you beat yourself up over the problem for a little while. Okay? So that's me where you are. Did that make sense? That said, if you're you know, one of these who writes everything on a piece of paper and puts, you know, two lines on the problem set which you hand in because you think it's neat, then you might not actually not be getting credit for that. And I want to, you know, make sure you know. The other thing is if there's a mix-up and a paper is lost, or you inadvertently put it in the wrong locker, or my TA's inadvertently grabbed the paper out of the wrong locker, I mean, I don't know. Then I'd like to catch that fairly fast. So they'll probably be able to turn around. We'll try to get that up on Blackboard soon. But I view a critical piece of the problem sets is for you, regardless of whether you think you understand the problem or not, is after you spend your time on it, spend time on the solution set that I post, or maybe the solutions that are in the library or both, and make sure you understand those. And then if you have questions, talk to me, talk to the TAs, talk to your friends who seem to know what they're doing. Okay? And that's very much an important part of your responsibility. No workshops this week. We'll have workshops probably next week. I say probably next week because sometimes I have to think a little bit about how I want to do the synchronization. Sometimes I'll have the workshops basically looking at stuff that you've already been doing. Sometimes I'll have it a little bit earlier. So it's hard to keep the synchronization right. We'll cover things in class. We'll cover things in problem sets. We'll cover things in workshop. And there is no religion as to which really comes first. So generally I'll try to talk about it in lecture first, but that's not how it always works out. But as I have to look at the timing of the material in the lecture, the workshop, and the problem set to decide whether the workshops start next week or the week after. Okay, any questions on any of that? Okay. Sadly, I always have to give grades. That's part of what we do. I mean, it's not necessarily sad, particularly in this class. Generally, people do pretty well. But so let me explain to you how it's going to work. So let's see. Let's talk about the different components first for just a moment. So we will have two exams during the course of the semester. One of them will be during class time in this room. The other will be during a common exam time, starting at 8 a.m. in some room I'll have to email you and tell you about. Okay? On the time when we have a common exam, you'll get. We will also have lecture that day. It's okay if you look a little brain dead during that particular lecture. You're welcome to bring in a shot of espresso or whatever. Maybe a shot of tequila. I mean, whatever. So you have my sympathy, but one of the reasons I do that is it sort of keeps me from wasting a class day and allows us to do a little bit more. So we will have these two, I'll call those term exams, and then we have a final exam, which is on December 20th, I think, at 4 in the afternoon. And then you also have labs that you have to do, and the labs are really run quite separately from the lecture. In fact, I pay no attention whatsoever to what's going on in the lab, which maybe in a better world wouldn't be that way, but you're sort of stuck. So those labs happen. They will feed me the grades, and I will put them in as part of your... I will factor them in as 15% of your grade in this class as a whole. So that's how it fits in. The other piece of that is if you don't do the labs, your grade is an N. That is, you get no grade. It is an important part of the class, but it doesn't dominate numerically in your grade. Okay? If you have questions about the lab, the person who's really in charge of the labs this semester is Professor Bodek, and you can talk to him. Generally speaking, there's an email address, which I have in the syllabus, called FizLabs. They may actually have broken it into a couple of different FizLabs addresses, so presumably you'll get that information. I'll check on that and send you an email if I think to do it about that. But anyway, you want to email FizLabs as your first... If you have a lab issue, that's where you want to start. And then if you're not hearing from FizLabs or what you hear is crap, then you talk to Professor Bodek. Okay? If what you're getting from all of them seems to be just wrong and not tractable for some reason, then come to me. But otherwise, I'm just going to give you a blank look instead of emailing FizLabs. Okay? So that's how the lab will work. So for problem sets, we'll do a problem set every week. I will have some mercy on you during weeks when you have exams, as whether that means no problem set or a very light problem set, I don't know. So generally, there'll be something like 12 or 13 problem sets. Now, I told you how I'm doing it in terms of your grade. I'm going to assume that every now and then you're going to have just a really bad week, or a really good week, but for whatever reason, you don't get around to doing your problem set. All right? So I give you three drops. No questions asked. I don't need to know about it. I don't want to negotiate anything. If your problem set ends up in the locker before 7 a.m. on Friday, we've got it. If not, we don't, and it's a drop. I don't need to know if it was a disaster in your family or if you met somebody really cool at a party and didn't want to do your physics that week. Whatever it is, I don't need to know. Okay? But I do have the flexibility in there. Having said that, this is not an easy class, so you definitely want to make sure that you cover your bases for that problem set, even if you didn't get it in. Okay? Because the material is still there. It's still going to be covered. All right? So what that means is you may do 12 problem sets, and you may get all 12 in my spreadsheet, and it just means I'll give you the 9 percentage points, no matter. Okay. If you do 7 problem sets, then you're going to get only the 7 percentage points. All right. So, any questions about that? Okay. So the other flexibility that I have built into the system is that I will evaluate your grade. Oh, I have one other thing. Sorry. There's one other component here, which is going to remain rather vague and ill-defined as of today.
That is, I'm going to ask each of you to participate with a group to make a presentation of some fairly ill-defined form for the class and teach them something cool at the end of the term. And cool is defined as something that has something to do with the material that we have in, that we're covering in this class, which, if you stop and think about it, covers most of reality as you know. So you shouldn't have any problem finding something really cool to think about and have fun exploring and then to share with the class. So the way we're going to do that is we'll divide up into some number of groups. I don't know quite how many. And you guys get to negotiate what you're interested in. We'll probably start out by I will hand out a whole list of topics that I think are sort of neat. And you can express interest in some number of those topics, and then I'll try to divide you into groups around interest. You're welcome. I'll hand out the topics early, and you can petition to have other topics added to the list if you think that there is something. Once we have the topic list, then you'll express your personal interest in the various topics, and I'll try to divide you up in some reasonable way where you have a topic that you're interested in and the group sizes are about what they need to be. And then you guys get to have the fun of exploring and working together on that topic, and then we'll try to give you about half an hour toward the end of the classes to actually teach or talk about it to the rest of the class. So that's sort of how it's going to work. Now, the other hitch here is I'm going to actually ask you all to rate each of the presentations for a number of criteria. And I will basically compile that score across all the groups, and that will define the starting point for group scores. I've done this kind of thing before. It usually works out pretty well. There was once in Physics 121 where a group came in and they made this absolutely spectacular presentation that had us all literally rolling in the aisles, but they actually forgot to talk about any physics. So they got scored the highest scores by everybody in the class, but I completely nailed them. Because I thought, okay, we can't do that. So I reserve the right to look for serious discrepancies between the actual grade and what the real criteria are that we're going to use for it. So I'm a safety valve. The scores are not at least reasonable in my estimation. So the one other catch to this is I'm going to ask each of you to give me feedback on other participants within your group. So if you are part of a group and you do nothing, then that will hurt your grade. Okay. If you're part of a group and you totally drive it, that may help your grade a little. But by and large, most of you are going to do fine. You're going to put in some effort on it. It will be your thing. And you know that means more or less you'll have the group scores. Generally, these scores are pretty high, so this is not a defining part of your grade. If you blow it off and it's a zero, it's a very defining part. It really does hurt you. So I don't mean to sound like this is something that can hurt you but not help you that much, but that's sort of what it is. I don't mean for it to be that way in grade. It's a lot of fun, and I hope that it'll be something you'll carry away from your class, because part of the problem with teaching often in this compartmentalized way that we do is I have a whole set of topics that I need to cover with you guys and things I want you to learn. And they're great topics, and they're really cool. But there's a whole lot of really fabulous stuff out there that I'm not going to spend time talking about. And I want you to pick and choose and entertain each other with some subset of those. Okay? Because there's a lot of neat stuff out there. And you'll see when I give you the topic list, and then you can invent your own. I won't define it any more than that right now. We'll talk about it later on the semester. But any questions right now on that? Okay. Alright, so those are the pieces, and then the additional flexibility I put in here is you'll note that
I have a bird.
You'll note that I will evaluate your grades three different ways. In one way, your grade is sort of spread across the three exams. These pieces are invariant. Okay? In the other two ways, we drop one of the exam scores, one of the term exam scores, and weight up the final. So this gives you some flexibility to have a bad day and still come out okay. If you're having trouble getting started, really getting the hang of the class, and your first grade isn't so great, there's flexibility in the syllabus for you to sort of get the hang of it and have it not have your grade not suffer at all. That's really what it's about, is a bit of a stress relief for you guys. Okay. The other thing that it's about, I won't lie to you, is that if something happens and you can't make one of those exams, then you automatically end up having your grade driven by two or three. Because I'm not going to do makeups. That may sound sort of lazy. Just it takes me better part of a week to make out a test that I think is fair. And if I try to do that with a makeup exam, there's just no way I can make it actually equivalent. Problems? There's too many subtleties as to what can throw the class or not. And so I find it's really hard to do that. So what I'd rather do is have this flexibility in here. If you miss one of the term exams, that automatically becomes one of your drops. Again, I don't need to know why. I mean, I wish you well. I hope if you miss it, it's for a good reason and not a bad one. But I don't need to know why. If you have if something bad happens and you miss exam one, then you know that's the score. If something then bad happens again and you miss exam two, then you need to come talk to me. Okay? We need to figure out what to do with that. We'll cross that bridge when we get there. Any questions about that? Okay, the other subtlety about grades is how it gets translated into letter grades and stuff.
Generally speaking, I'm pretty good at making out exams where the mean often falls around 65%. And I don't know whether that sounds low or high to some of you. Depends on what courses you've had so far. Every time I think I'm a hard ass, I meet some professor whose mean is 20 points lower than mine. So, who knows? The way to think about it is I design it that way because I find if I have a much higher mean, I can't distinguish students who are really got it all from students who have a lot of it. And if I have the mean much lower, then I find I completely lose any distinguishing among students that are sort of on the lower edge of the curve. And I find somewhere at 65, it spread things out nicely enough that I feel like I get a decent evaluation of students at the high end, the low end, and the middle. So that's why I do it that way. That can mean that, you know, for one of these typical exams, you're not going to walk out feeling real warm and fuzzy about it necessarily, right? Because the mean is 65. So, okay, just expect that. That said, the mean is usually about a B in my class. Okay, so that's not so bad, even if you feel like you got hit by a truck. In fact, you don't know whether you got hit by the truck until you see the curve and how everybody else did. So generally, I'm pretty good at that, so I know roughly what to expect. Okay. However, I will tell you that now and then, there's something that I don't expect that happens during the exam, and the exam is either a good bit more hard or a good bit easier than I was expecting it to be. Because I make up new exams every time. All of my old exams are going to be available to you on the web. All right. I don't repeat problems because I assume that if you know what you're doing, you've got your hands on my old exams anyway. But I will make them available to all of you because I want it to be even. It's also great practice, but then it means that every exam is new, which means sometimes there are unexpected problems. So what that means is that since I allowed the drop, I can't have your letter grade driven by, oh, I just happened to be sick on the day that the heart exam happened. Right? So I have to have a way to normalize out
the possible differences and difficulties for the three exams. So the way that I do that is I basically scale them such that the mean is the same for each of the three exams. So what that means is that I will take the mean score for each of the three exams, and I will take everybody's grade for that exam and multiply it by 100 over the mean for that exam. So that basically takes the entire curve and slides it up to where it's centered at 100 for that exam. And then I'll do that same thing for the other exams, but their means are different. So if they're really hard, then they get slid up more. If they're really easy, they get slid up a little less. So what it does is to first order... Do you get that lingo? Have you been in physics enough to get that? I use that at dinner, you know, and Grandma looks at me like, what are you talking about? So we're going to actually do sort of perturbation theory of sorts. So this whole first order thing can make a lot of sense to you that doesn't get. But what it means is that more or less, I normalize out the difficulties of the three exams. It's not perfect, right? It's not perfect in the sense that if one of the reasons the exam is much harder is that I put in an extra problem and it became very long and got half of you stressed out for time and you weren't thinking physics, there's an additional effect in there that's not really normalized out. That's going to affect some of you more than others, which might broaden it out. I can't really normalize that out. So they're not. It's not. I can't completely correct this out, but I can do it largely by just basically putting the means on top of each other. Then once, so then I will evaluate your grade each of these three ways. We don't have to talk about which way you want me to evaluate. I'll do it all three ways, and I'll take the one that gives you the highest percentage. And then I will create a distribution that takes the highest percentage for each of you individually, and I'll call that your best numerical average. And that's the final distribution that I'll use for letter grades. And then generally, if the class is a reasonable class and not anomalously strong or anomalously weak, I will more or less take the mean of that distribution, and that's a B, fairly wide B range, and you know, it's probably not so easy to make an A and not so easy to make, well. You can certainly make a C if you try. But I don't have a quota system really. So it depends a little on you as individuals. If you are getting your clock cleaned in the class and you are working hard and you're trying and, you know, I know who you are, you've actually been to ask questions and things like that, you might have a grade that falls well below that basic distribution. And you might be worried that, by definition, that means you're going to fail the class. That's not necessarily true. If you expect to get a C or better in the class, your grade probably needs to be somewhere within that distribution or such. But if you're down here, then I take a lot of other things into account, okay, as to whether I'm going to fail you in the class or not. So if you do find yourself in that situation toward the end of the semester, you're worried about whether to drop the class or not, feel free to come talk to me. But I generally reserve failing for students that are down there and who don't actually show evidence of having done much. It's not good if I don't know who you are because you've never been allowed to ask questions. Any questions on how the grading is going to work? Yes?
Are you going to normalize based on standard deviation test scores or just the mean?
Just the mean. I mean, I might change that, but generally I just do the mean. I mean, I think that does it to first order. Part of that is this shouldn't go out of this room. When I try to explain a grading system like this to Physics 113, you'd have thought it's a class in field theory. No matter what I do, at the end of the term, about a third of that class cannot seem to understand why their grades got changed. And I get accused of changing grades arbitrarily. And I can explain the whole idea of trying to normalize for fairness till I'm blue in the face. And it just doesn't get through. So the idea of adding complexity to the system gives me the willies. But I might be able to do it for this class. I hope. Yeah. So, all right. Anything else about the class?
Okay, so what is workshop? How many of you are freshmen? Okay, sophomores. Mostly. All right.
So most of you have probably had a class where they had something called a workshop. And so what it is for me is you'll meet 2 hours a week with one of the TAs in the class, and you'll meet with a group of 10 to 15 students in this class, sort of depending on the schedule. A little larger than I would like it to be, but we're sort of forced into that. And then, as a group, you'll go through a series of these problems. Some of them are going to be conceptual. Some of them are going to be very complicated. They'll give you exercise and a lot of different things. And what I'd like you to do is to help each other out. And your TA may work with you. Sometimes you may work as a total group. Sometimes you may work in pairs. When you sort of come to what you think is the solution, then convince each other that you've got the right answer. So this is meant to be a sort of all-for-one, one-for-all thing. And it is a slow process, so I'm hoping most of the time you'll actually spend most of the 2 hours. But between that and the problem sets, that's actually where most of your learning is going to happen. I mean, I hope that lecture won't be a waste of your time, but if you have to pick and choose, go to workshop and do your problems. Any questions about that? All right. Okay. We can actually do physics. So any questions at all about how the course is going to run? Yes?
Is there going to be labs this week?
There will not be labs this week. Whether it starts next week, I actually doubt it. I think it'll be in a couple of weeks, but I can't guarantee you about it. Anything else? Yes?
Do we have labs every week, or do they, every other week, or alternates?
I believe that they will run in two-week things, and you'll probably alternate. But again, partly why I'm not so sure. I'm pretty sure... Yeah, I'm not actually sure. And I can't tell you whether you're doing them with 122 same labs or whether they've now put in honors labs for 142 separately. The intent was there at some point. Whether it happened or not, you should have a professor who pays more attention to the world. Yes?
Turning in labs.
Turning in labs? I can tell you how they do it in 113, 114, which is where they do the lab and hand it in at the end of class. But if, in fact, they are doing honors labs with you guys, it could be different. And I don't know. Yes?
Just to add in, I just looked it up. The fall 2014 week lab cycle, eight labs start to leave September 15th.
A and B labs tells you it's going to be every other week thing. Does it tell you when to hand them in?
Tell us during
lab. I'm sure they'll figure it out.
Doesn't social psychology come in like during the lab?
That may well be. I know that we were doing that for the other classes. But okay, so any questions about the lecture part? All right. So, a lot of what we're going to learn is launched from some work that this guy did, Charles Coulomb, in 1875. So, what he found was that there is a similarity between gravitation and, I mean, I don't know if he thought of it that way, but what he found was that there's an inverse square relationship in the force between electrically charged particles, whatever that means. And that wasn't even clear what that meant at the time. They often sort of thought of charge as a fluid, and it works pretty well when you think about it. But you all should be experts on gravitation. So if I have a mass, some mass 1 sitting here, and I have another mass 2 over here, you can ask, what is the force of one of the particles on the other? So say the force of M1 on M2, or M2 on M1. And we can define the position of one with respect to the other by using a vector that runs from one point to the other, which I'll call vector R.
What does that mean?
Unit vector.
And what is a unit vector?
So it's magnitude 1 in the direction of your original vector.
So a unit vector is a bit simpler. It just gives you a direction. Okay? So if this is vector R, the unit vector here is a vector of unit magnitude, which is in the same direction. All right? And in my notation, it gets the little hat over it. I think that's pretty standard. So what this is saying is that M2, I guess this would be more the force of
2 on 1, the way I have it written.
So M2 exerts a force on M1 in that direction. That's what that, of this magnitude. So it drops off as 1 over the distance squared. And it depends on the magnitude of these masses, whatever mass it is. Okay? So that you should be pretty familiar with. That's Newton's law of gravity. And electromagnetism is pretty similar, except for 2 things. One is that if you measure these forces, you find that sometimes it can be both attractive and sometimes repulsive. In fact, I can take out the reference for this one. I can take out this reference. And put in that minus sign, because what that really means is that this is an attractive force. So if I ask what is the force of M2 on M1, So if you're asking what is the force of M2 on M1, then M2 is at a position R, and what am I not doing right here? I need to rethink this, sorry. There's a nice way to explain this. I'll try to do better on that Thursday. Think about when I say do that. Basically, though, this minus sign, it works better from a potential point of view. So we'll come back to it if I don't do it well on Thursday. This basically defines the force as an attractive force. And so here, it turns out it can be yes.
The negative sign will only make sense if we, when we talk about the force of 2 on 1, and we define vector R as 2 on 1, but on the graph we have 1 to 2.
Right, right. Yeah, so I'm getting ahead of myself because it turns out there's a nice way to do this when you're thinking of it in terms of potential and you're taking a derivative of it and you're looking at how the force works as the gradient of the potential. And I probably shouldn't have tried to do it here in this particular way, so I need to think about how best to do that. At any rate, here, sometimes it's repulsive and sometimes it's not. So a way to handle that mathematically is to have the charge of the force have two signs algebraically, positive and negative. And if these are both the same charge, then you have a positive sign here, and that will translate into a repulsive force. If these are opposite the sign, you end up with an algebraic negative sign, and you'll end up with an attractive force. You may never have really thought of it this way, but in terms of basic forces, gravity has charge. The charge is the mass, but there's only one type of charge. So the force is always attractive. It's the same sort of thing. There's another little subtlety here. Is what you'll notice is that the basic characteristic of the force is such that it depends on the amount of charge that you've got. It depends on the inverse square of the distance. And then there's a constant. In the case of gravity, it's G. In the case of electromagnetism, it's this K. And that sets the scale of the force. So you can go and you can use a torsion balance if you want, which is done for both gravitational and electromagnetic measurements. And you can so the way a torsion balance works is that you hang a very stiff wire from something, and you can then hang a ball here and a ball here. Those balls may have particular masses or charges put on them. And you then can approach it with a mass or a charge, depending, or different masses or charges. So, for example, I can have a Q1 here and a Q1 here and some Q here. And what you'll find is that if I approach it, so I basically have this torsion balance. So I have a stiff wire in my finger with this thing hanging. I have a ball here and a ball here. I now approach it from the side. If there's a force between these, it'll cause the wire to twist a little bit. Okay? And I can then let it go and it will oscillate. And so I can actually get a measure of how much this force is by the way the amplitude of this oscillation changes with time, depending on how big a mass or charge I have and how close it starts out. So you can sort of use this and its oscillatory behavior, because it's at small angles, a torsion. If you torque a wire, it's like simple harmonic motion. And but if you have something over here that exerts a force, it's like dance simple harmonic motion. From that, you can actually extract the force. So you've probably worried about that kind of stuff in mechanics a bit. So what will happen is this thing will sort of rotate, and you can get a measure of the force. And from this, you can determine that the force is proportional to the charges that you place, whatever they happen to be, over r squared. But now what you'd like to do is to somehow, if you were to have multiple forces in nature that have this kind of thing, you'd like to be able to distinguish them by their basic strength. So that's one of the things these constants do. They sort of give you a magnitude given the units that you choose for the charge and distance. Okay. In the end, for this class, the unit of force is always going to be newtons. So we're going to measure mass in something, we're going to measure charge in something, so it's going to be kilograms and coulombs. Having done that, you will measure force
And this constant is what changes it from Coulomb squared to meter squared into newtons. So it sort of gets the units right and it sets the magnitude. There's something else that's very important, especially in electromagnetism. In gravity, they're just sort of boring. It's just G. Okay? In electromagnetism, we have a little subtlety. K sometimes is written as K. And I actually have the numbers here. So if we want to write it as K, it's 8.99 times 10 to the 9th Newton meter squared per Coulomb squared. So the units are driven by the fact that you want to end up with newtons and you want to figure out the coulombs and the meters and come up with something that's a force. But the really fabulous thing, and one of the things that will make you really happy that you decide to be a physicist, is that, just for fun, sometimes we will write K as 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught, okay? And epsilon naught is something which we will call, it's got to sound cool, all right? So we will call this the permittivity of free space. See, that's cool. And it is a now, because we've redefined things, it's going to be also a constant that has a particular numerical value. Why should you be happy about this?
It's constant.
It is constant. But constants are easy, right? G is a constant. What's intimidating about that? This is fabulous because it's total job security. If you can take something simple and make it a bit opaque by simply redefining the constant, nobody's going to know what the hell you're doing. So a lot of this class is for you guys to pull out your special decoder readings and keep track of this crap. Then you're in the know. Total job security. Because now nobody knows what you're doing. And you've taken something like K, and you have transformed it into permittivity of free space. Okay? Now it's a totally cool constant. Did you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, I mean, another useful thing is that you didn't, if it wasn't in the free space, if it was a different medium, then...
Okay, now you're getting into the real reasons for it. Yeah.
So, okay, why do we really have this? Because we could have this force going through materials instead of in free space. And in fact, the way you handle that is you make the measurements and you create a table of things which are permittivities of the materials, and this constant will actually vary because the field is different if you're in materials for lots of reasons that we'll talk about. And so there is a difference, and you get where that is.
So if the permittivity of the space changes, does the magnetic force at least change, or does it always stay tied to the free space constant?
There's a bit of it, yeah, so there's a subtlety. If you're inside a material, the field that you feel, the electric force that you feel, is changed. Okay. There are different ways to look at that. One way of looking at that is to say, if I have a particle here that's creating the condition in space that we call an electric field over here, conveying the force, we'll talk about that later in the week, that you can think of that field as being changed because of the material. Or you can think of, theoretically, that field being exactly what it was, but you now superimpose the field of all the intervening things in the material, which changes it. So so I'm not sure how to answer that question. We'll come back to it.
Okay.
Maybe ask it again after we sort of look through stuff.
But I think you answered it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so there are sort of different ways of looking at it. You end up in the same place, so, and you'll want to get good at looking at it both ways. Do you have a question?
Why don't we just, you know, recall that whole thing, C squared, because due to the definition of permittivity, it ends up being equivalent to just C squared.
C squared being speed of light
or pi squared? Because the permittivity is defined as 1 over the permeability times C squared, and the permeability is defined as 4 pi. So the whole thing goes down to a C squared, which makes it a lot simpler, I think.
Well, I have to think a little bit in MKS units. If you're in CGS units, in fact, I think you do that. I'll have to think a little bit whether there's some unit thing that's tied up in there.
I think the numbers work out.
So. Yeah. At any rate, we'll do a lot more of that kind of stuff as the semester goes on. As of now, you haven't heard the word light. We'll get there in another 6 weeks. We'll actually derive that. I think I am probably officially out of time. Any questions? Okay, this is Tuesday, right? Yeah, so class on Thursday. And I will try to post the first problem set for you later today. Wait a minute. I'm wrong. I'm sorry. We have till 12:20. But we started at 11:05, so 12:05. It just sort of morphed in my head. Sorry. Never mind. We're gonna keep going. All right. So permittivity of free space, epsilon naught, is equal to 8.85 times 10 to the minus 12 coulombs squared per Newton meter squared. We just heard a discussion about C squares. You need to... We will use C to represent the speed of light. We will use C to represent coulombs. So part of what you have to figure out is when is which one meant. Right? So it's context. It's true it's little c for speed of light, big C for coulomb. Most people I know might not really know what you're looking at when you just see a C. So context will be very important. And what one of the things that you will find is we definitely don't have enough symbols to represent all the various things that we're trying to represent. Okay, So what sets science apart from other endeavors where you're trying to understand the world around you?
The experiments.
Do experiments.
So you have a process, so you did use...
You have a process, a scientific method or whatever.
You can be wrong.
You can be wrong. It's a big one. And these are all tied together. Right? So one of the things that makes science particularly powerful in terms of its methodology is that you may develop some picture of reality that you think is right, and you then go out and you try to do experiments. And it may be that you've done some observations in order to formulate this thing in the first place. One of the absolutely critical aspects of science, and the thing that really sets it apart from, say, religion, is if you make an observation that you all agree it's a good observation and it clearly refutes your model, the model needs to be revised. And you have to, this is the powerful thing, the methodology is sort of iterative, but you keep revising your model so that you try to keep it in agreement with what you observe in nature. So, one of the things that doesn't happen in the world of science as we know it
is that
the rules are not handed down to us on stone tablets. Okay? So you go and you look, and you look to see what the world is telling you about these things that you're measuring. And they may not be what you were expecting. But when you do that with electromagnetism, we find a couple of things which I don't know whether you find them weird or not, but they just sort of are the way it appears to be. One is that electric charge is conserved. So what I mean by that,
I might destroy a particle that carries charge. But in the process of doing it, whatever charge I started with, I end up in the final state that's about the same charge. So the overall net charge is neither created or destroyed in any isolated process. I don't know that it had to be that way, but that's the way it is.
I think it has some pretty interesting implications when we get into, I don't know how much we'll get into it in this class, but if you think about relativity with E equals mc squared, the sort of equivalence between energy and mass, if I have so much energy, it could turn into particles. If it turns into a charged particle, because you basically are starting with zero charge, it also has to turn into a particle with opposite charge. So I have a feeling that the existence of antimatter is tied up with this at some level, some deep level. So I think that this is a pretty important, it's telling us something pretty important about nature. Another thing that is didn't have to be but happens to be is that electric charge is quantized. Meaning what? Yes?
It only exists in integer multiples of the basic charge, I forget what the way it is.
There is a smallest charge, and it's universal. Any other charge is an integral multiple of that charge. And certainly in the larger world around us, as we look at charge, that quantization is lost on us. It looks quite continuous because the smallest charge, which is the charge on an electron or the charge on a proton, is very, very small. So if you're dealing with macro amounts of it, you don't notice the difference if you take one electron or another. But if I take little oil drops and I deposit random amounts of charge on them and I try to measure their charge, there's something called the oil drop experiment, what you will find is that you can find multiples of a particular charge, but you can never find something that's smaller than that. Again, probably something really fundamentally important about nature that people do try to understand. But it's just a fact. Okay? It's also a bit of a lie. So that fundamental charge, which we usually just call E, sometimes E without the absolute values, is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. So one thing you'll discover is if you're doing problems where we deal with macroscopic amounts of charge moving around, so some, you know, potato-shaped thing that we pile a bunch of charge, then it makes sense to talk about coulombs. All right, if we're talking about how much charge is flowing through some big wire that we're doing in the real world, then coulombs and amperes and things are units that make sense. If we start talking about things that are subatomic in nature, like single particles moving through magnetic fields or between two charged plates or something, then it turns out that coulombs is sort of sometimes a painful unit to use because the charge on a single one of those particles is this 10 to the minus 19. So we'll have to learn to deal with that a little bit. Sometimes you actually will do problems working in units of E, meaning this many coulombs, but you can sort of worry about it in terms of E up until at least the last moment where you might have to convert things into newtons or whatever. So I said I lied. It turns out that if you take beams of electrons and you scatter them off of nucleons, like protons and stuff, you find that the way the scattering happens, it is consistent with the particles scattering off of particles with fractional charge inside the nucleon. And we have a lot more evidence for that. If you know Professor Bodek, in fact, his thesis project was doing that at Stanford, and his advisor won the Nobel Prize for it. Not a bad word for a thesis. So the way that quarks work in the quark picture, that we have, there are two types. There are quarks with a charge of plus 2/3, and there are quarks with a charge of minus 1/3. So, in fact, we know of 6 quarks: the up quark, the down quark, the charm quark, the strange quark, the top quark, and the bottom quark. There actually is some sense to where the names come from, but I won't waste your time with that right now. For the most part, it serves as job security for us because somebody, you know, yes, I'm getting paid to study strange bodies, and they'll just look at me like, what are you talking about? When you could be doing very serious particle physics, in fact. Anyway, it turns out that the ones on the top have a charge of plus 2/3, and the ones on the bottom have a charge of minus 1/3. And oddly enough, you never see these particles in isolation. If I try to take two quarks and blast them apart, as I pull them apart, the force between them, which is the strong nuclear force, or quantum chromodynamics, becomes stronger and stronger to the point that the potential energy in space here as they're blowing apart is so great that effectively it becomes energetically favorable to create a particle-antiparticle pair in free space, which then join the other two particles. So I end up not with individual particles, but with paired particles that have the charge. So it's pretty bizarre stuff. So the particles that we see in nature are particles that have three quarks, or a quark and an antiquark. And these we call baryons, and these we call mesons. Examples of a baryon might be a proton. And a proton is thought to be made of two up quarks and a down quark, which gives you the quantized charge of plus one. A neutron has one up quark and two down quarks, which has a quantized charge of zero. All right, there are other particles, pi mesons, for example. You can have an up and an anti-up, or an up and an anti-down to get a charge of plus one, etc. So that's sort of a game you play. So it is a law. You can, we have theories. We have very well-known theory. Nobel Prizes have been given for it. Quantum chromodynamics, which explains the interaction of these particles into particles that we discover in nature. But these we cannot see in isolation, even though they are fractionally charged. The only particles we've ever been able to see in nature happen to have integral electric charge. Any thoughts, questions about any of that? All right. That's probably a good place to start. We have the misfortune, I think, of having 113 coming after. So there's going to be this loud board.